ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
This week, it's the most marvellous time of the year. The under-16 social media ban is upon us, and so are the legal challenges. While a lot of the country begins to wind down, the media landscape is about to experience an earthquake.
And media mayhem in the stock market. But who's buying who?
And it may be the festive season, but radio's killing season rolls on unabated.
You love a media share market story, Tim, and you've had plenty of little treats this week.
Look, I have, Viv, and the danger is I'm going to disappear into kind of some sort of nerd rabbit hole. So you're going to have to try and drag me back if I get too much into the minutiae, because we're at the point of a couple of moves on the share market involving media companies that we don't actually fully know what they mean, but it feels like they mean something. So the two things I'm thinking about are News Corp has sold its long-held stake in ARN Media. So News Corp, the people who publish The Australian, The Telegraph, The Courier Mail, et cetera, and own Sky News Australia. And ARN Media, the people who bring us people like Kyle Sanderlands on Kiss FM and people like Jonesy and Amanda on The Gold Network, along with Christian O'Connell. So News has held this stake forever, but this week, for some reason, they sold their 13.2% stake. So that went on.
I guess one of the things, Tim, that perhaps people who don't care about the share market might not appreciate is that a lot of companies that are seemingly competitors do own these minor or relatively minor stakes in each other. So even though they're competing for advertising revenue and they're competing for audience ears, if the other company is financially successful, they actually do often get a bit of money back because they might own, say, 15% of that competitor.
Yeah, you're right. And the 15% number is relevant because there are a number of rules around media ownership and the maximum number of radio licenses or mixture of different kind of media properties you can own. So these different companies, they'll tend to take a sort of a strategic stake just below 15%, which will then allow them to kind of, you know, also play a role when there are other deals going on, which is one of the kind of intriguing things about News selling its ARN stake now. Because what does all of the speculation is, does this mean News is about to make another move in radio? And then that speculation became even more interesting because late on Thursday of this week, we also learned that ARN, which in turn ended up owning a stake in Southern Cross Austereo, which it tried to merge with many months back, has sold down some of its stake in SCA. So lots happening in audio. And when we think about the fact that we know that Nine, who owns Nine Radio, which includes 2GB and 3AW and other stations around the rest of the country, they appear to be selling off their radio division. So it feels like the jigsaw pieces are being moved around, but I can't quite make out what the picture is yet, Viv.
I can feel all of your conspiracies brewing, Tim, about who's going to own who and what this all means. Is there a chance these media companies are all just in trouble and are looking for a chance to make a buck on the stock market? Does it actually mean anything?
There is a small possibility. I mean, the reported number that Nine got for its sale of its stake in ARM was something like $18 million. Now, does the company really need the money that much?
Yes.
To sell right now? Well, yeah, I mean, yes, it does, because it, like all kind of traditionally based media companies, advertising revenue has really fallen off something of a cliff this year in particular. So it could just be that. But also, having sat on it for years, why sell right at this moment when the price of ARN is right at its lowest point? I think the You know, and we record this on a Friday morning, so by the time people are listening, I could already be proved wrong. But I think the other shoe may yet drop.
Well, it's not just been a weird week in the media share market for the audio companies. It's also been a weird week for media talent.
Yeah, we've talked many times about killing season, Viv, and it rolls on for hosts and managers alike. And over the last sort of few days, we've seen several big moves from both sides of the microphone.
Lauren Joyce, who was the Chief Content and Audience Officer at ARN, which, as you mentioned, Tim, has the KIIS and Gold networks across radio, as well as the iHeart Radio digital platform. Her role has been made redundant, and I always feel like I need to clarify that point. There's so many HR specialists and psychologists out there who tell you you're not allowed to say that a person was made redundant. Their role was made redundant. But it certainly led to a lot of speculation because Lauren Joyce was effectively in charge of the content that was coming out of that company. And the content is the thing that has been getting criticism, scrutiny, all of those things because of all of the spotlights on Kyle and Jackie O at the moment.
And particularly around the strategy for next year and what they might or might not do in Brisbane has been one of the big points of debate.
Yeah, and it's one of those strange things with redundancies where if you make a role redundant, you're then not supposed to immediately replace that exact role because then you couldn't argue that it is not needed/redundant. So ARN are going back to the Chief Content Officer role, which is what they had before. They had this audience and content officer role. So it does just feel like sort of moving chess pieces to try and get the correct person into that role. And it's not yet clear who that person will be because Lauren was really respected in a lot of ways for her audience insights and for certain strategic decisions she'd made in other roles. But I think it's clear that she failed to rein in Kyle. Now, who can rein in Kyle? Do they want him to be reined in? We're just not sure, but it will be really interesting to see who takes that role.
And we also wonder about when they'll finally bring the Kyle and Jackie O show into Brisbane, having announced a relatively surprising move with Craig Lowe initially taking that slot for them in Brisbane. And we've seen Nova react to that in the last few days as well, Viv.
Yeah, again, this killing season feels particularly strange only because it's been going on for so long. Robin Bailey had been at KIIS in Brisbane in the breakfast show, and she was a really respected long-term member of sort of the Brisbane presenting market. And she obviously has been ditched in favour of Craig Lowe, which many radio strategists aren't sure what that's doing. Is it a placeholder before Kyle and Jackie O come steaming in? Is it just because it's a cheaper option to have one host instead of three?
And Viv, it goes beyond KIIS in Brisbane to Nova as well.
Yeah, there are so many moving pieces in this, Tim. A while ago, a breakfast show in Brisbane on Nova's 106.9 was Ash Lutzi and Susie O'Neill. So that was David Lutterell, Ash Bradnam, and former Olympian Susie O'Neill. Susie then left and was replaced by comedian Nikki Osborne. And then in recent weeks, Ash Bradnam has announced that he's leaving the show not of his own accord. So he released a statement saying, "I've literally done it all in Brekkie Radio. It's a lot of fun, but Brekkie Radio is also a brutal business. And I think just cold-hearted blindsiding completes the full experience for me." So he clearly wasn't happy about it, and everybody was speculating that perhaps a man who has professionally been known as Ducko, but whose birth certificate has his name as Nick. So he's switching now to just be Nick rather than Ducko, and will be forming the Nick Lutzi and Susie O'Neill show for Nova 106.9 Breakfast in 2026. So Susie's back. Ducko, also known as Nick, who formerly hosted the hit breakfast show across regional New South Wales, is sort of completing that moving part for Nova Brisbane, at least.
And it doesn't even end there, does it? Today Today FM, which was once Sydney's biggest FM commercial station, it's been a while, they had their own change this week as well.
Yeah, Jimmy Smith, who was a co-host of the Jimmy and Nath with Emma show on Today FM Breakfast in Sydney, his was another sudden departure. In fact, it was effective immediately. And Jimmy and Nath have been a duo for quite a while. They do things outside of radio as well. They've written books, they do gigs. And a lot of people thought that they were trying to be the next Hamish and Andy. Now, I don't know if that's fair. I feel like any male duo who tried to use a bit of comedy got lumped with the accusation that they were just trying to be the next Hamish and Andy. Whether or not that's fair, though, that very much was a perception that followed those two around. And unfortunately, they didn't quite reach those heights. I'm not sure that anyone can reach the heights of Hamish and Andy in this modern media market, but Jimmy is gone, and all that Today FM have sort of said was that it was for his mental health and that he needed to focus on that. It was effective immediately, but it leaves the Today FM breakfast show quite open for 2026 because Emma and the remaining part of the duo, Nath, might be talented broadcasters, but they're not sort of the duo that was meant to be together. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were even more changes to come.
No, they've certainly not been announced as doing the show next year just yet. I'll put you on the spot. Predictions, any more to come in this year's radio killing season?
There's lots of speculation that there are going to be shuffles in Sydney for Nova. So I don't think the chess pieces have stopped moving yet. It's just whether any of them sort of fall down in the process or if it's going to be more and more shuffling of the same pieces on the same board.
It's all about jigsaws and chess pieces today, Viv. You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
Well, it's not quite Christmas, but it is a special time. It's time for the social media under 16 restrictions. They kick into effect formally this coming Wednesday, which is the 10th of December, although some companies have already gone early with their age-gating attempts, Viv.
And Minister for Communications Annika Wells has a grand plan, as she laid out in a National Press Club speech this week.
In 1 week, Australia will become the first country in the world to ban under 16s from having social media accounts. With one law, we can protect Generation Alpha from being sucked into purgatory by predatory algorithms described by the man who created the feature as behavioural cocaine. Through one reform, more kids will have their time back to learn an instrument or a language or walk their dog, or master a torpedo punt, or the perfect lob pass.
Well, Annika Wells might see it as a higher calling, but others are maybe a little bit less than sure.
Cam Wilson has been covering the restrictions and all the noise around them since their inception. We don't have any scientific research, but we think he's covered it more than anyone else.
Hey, Cam, thank you for joining us on Medialand.
Hi, good to be here. And yeah, it certainly feels like I've been covering it a lot, so I'm glad I'll have some use for the knowledge that I can share with you guys.
So, Cam, we've been discussing what the restrictions actually are for, it feels like, literally years now. As you understand it, what is going to happen on Wednesday?
Yeah, so Wednesday is the deadline for social media platforms in Australia to place a restriction on people aged under 16 from having accounts on their platforms. It came from a law that was actually passed a year ago. There was a year to figure out the details. In that time, we've had government commission trials, which has looked at the technology. We've had advice from regulators. We've had a growing game of whack-a-mole about who is in and outside of the ban. But at this point, what is going to happen is that most of the major social media platforms that you can think of, you know, your Facebooks, now your YouTube, Snapchat, are all planning to, by that date, if not earlier, as in the case of some of them, get rid of what will be probably more than 1 million accounts across their platforms that they suspect belong to people under the age of 16.
Now, Cam, it's rare that I would take the side of a tech giant owned by an American billionaire, but I understand their perspective that perhaps it does feel a bit like a game of whack-a-mole, as you mentioned, and maybe it hasn't been clear what exactly they need to do on the 10th of December. A lot of the wording in the documents that have been released by the government are kind of saying, well, look, these social media platforms, they know how to target you with advertising. They know your demographic information. They know who you are and what you're interested in. So surely they can just work out the tech and the policies for banning under 16s. Do you think it's sort of fair that they feel a bit unsure about how this is going to play out in a week's time?
Yeah, so I mean, from the start, the government has always said, hey, we're putting the onus on the platforms to figure this out. We're the government, they're the tech experts, you know, we'll let those eggheads figure out how to do it. And to the government's credit, you know, they didn't entirely say you're on your own. They did run this government trial or government commissioned trial that looked at the technologies to understand it, to look at how well some of the providers of those technologies work, and also just to kind of prove, you know, how you can use them. So there was that, but they've said you guys are being responsible for it. But the whole way that they've kind of said, you need to figure it out, we're not even going to give you benchmarks for example, how accurate these systems have to be. You've just got to take reasonable steps. And what reasonable steps are, you know, is partly up to advice given by the eSafety Commissioner, which is the regulator, and ultimately, should it get to this, the courts, if we decide you're not doing it well enough and we're going to levy a penalty against you, which can be up to $50 million for systemic failures. So I understand why the tech companies feel like they're being hard done by. They, you know, don't have any clear, you know, measurements or benchmarks that they have to hit. But at the same time, I can understand why the government is like, we're not going to give you, you know, the bare minimum standards, because then we think that you'll only teach to the test. You'll only do exactly what you have to do and not any better. It's obviously this kind of complex area. The thing that I would kind of say is that what we've seen from how this government, and in particular this regulator that's responsible, the eSafety Commissioner, how they've used these powers and similar powers in the past, is that they haven't just immediately handed out fines for what they think is poor performance. They've kind of worked with them, given them information, given them warnings. And so I think, you know, while they maybe aren't getting strict guidelines about how exactly they need to comply with it, it's not just going to be something that come December 10, we're going to see these big fines handed out for a failure to meet standards that aren't really clear.
Cam, something which people have asked me a couple of times about this is this sense of, we're hearing a lot from the platforms talking about how it might not work and the flaws with the policy. Is there a possibility that they will just deliberately not make a very good job of it?
I've heard that too. And in fact, I think, so 36 Months, which is one of the main groups behind pushing for this ban, has now very vocally been like, we think that they are sabotaging it. We heard the South Australian Premier, again, a key figure behind this, say similar things last week. I'm a little bit more skeptical about that because, one, obviously there is this, they face fines for failing to do it properly. Two, as well, the idea of sabotaging it ultimately means, let's make this as painful as possible for our users. If you're a tech company, you don't actually want to make something that painful. My understanding, and this is how I think about it, is if everything goes well, both the government and the tech companies want this to go as smoothly as possible so that they can kind of, you know, go past it and not have to worry about it too much anymore. The idea that they would want a kind of friction doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. You know, they want to keep their users. They don't want to be fined. So I personally don't think that that makes much sense. I can see why you might think that. And I can also see the sense that, you know, these tech companies, to be fair, have made a lot of noise in the lead up to this saying that we don't want it, but I don't think they're actually going to sabotage it when it's going to happen. I'd personally need to see more proof to believe something like that.
Cam, in addition to your role as Associate Editor of Crikey, you are the co-author of a book called Conspiracy Nation. And one thing I've seen online around these potential blocks or ways that they're going to enforce these blocks is they could ask people for their government-issued ID. And there's a number of people who feel like it's just another way for the tech giants and the government to conspire against them and get more information about them and track them even more online. Are those fears founded or unfounded, do you think?
Well, thank you for the plug. And I'll refer back to the book, which is that, you know, we say that, you know, the most compelling conspiracy theories have a kernel of truth in them. Those are the ones that really take hold. And in that, I would say, I don't think that this is a government scheme to introduce or mandate digital ID for going online. In fact, there is actually provision in the teen social media ban law saying you may not only offer digital ID. So they've actually made it harder. Like it could have been possible that tech companies may have just said, well, the easiest thing for us to do is just say, if you want to prove your age, you have to log in with digital ID and that's easy. We don't have to worry about all this other stuff. They made that actually impossible or against the law. That being said, you know, there are only a few ways that you can prove your identity. Some of them are less precise and less proven. So things like facial scans. And if a face scan, you know, for whatever reason doesn't evaluate that you're 16 or over, you know, maybe like me, you've got a bit of a baby face, maybe people often think that you're younger. For many of the platforms, the only alternative you do have is giving some government ID. And there is a real risk that, you know, in a way that's never been needed before, to go online, you will be having to give more of your information to these platforms. I think that's less about government control. And for me, the risk of things being leaked, more information being handed over creates more risk for people and more potential for harm.
And for a determined 14-year-old who wants inexplicably to remain on social media, how or can they get around it?
Yes, I think so. And the government has been pretty clear about that from the start. You know, they've messaged saying that we don't expect this to be perfect. And particularly in the lead up to this deadline over the last few weeks, they've been really, really loudly talking about how people will get around it. And I've seen people getting around it. I've seen kids fooling systems. I've seen kids getting their parents to, you know, vouch for them by either scanning their faces or providing their ID. And obviously, as well, kids migrating to alternative platforms that they don't think will enforce the law. There's no doubt that kids will get around it. The government has said we accept that, but ultimately we're trying to create this social change and, you know, change the expectation that everyone is on these platforms at this age. My question is, and I don't think this has been really well answered, is at what point does that, you know, at what point of kids getting around it, does that actually challenge this new social expectation you're creating? And, you know, to their credit, the people I speak to who are for the ban, some of the parents, people who are pushing it, they say, any kid off the platform is good to us. So I think that, you know, for supporters of the ban, the expectation is that anything is good. I'm kind of curious about what everyone else will think if we do see widespread circumvention.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National with Tim Burrows and me, Vivian Kelly. We're speaking to Cam Wilson, the associate editor of Crikey, about the looming social media ban for under 16s. Cam, you've just been speaking about the way that these teenagers might find workarounds for any kind of enforcement of this ban. Have there been any sort of more formal challenges to this? And what arguments are the kids making that this is unfair or unjust?
The main challenge that we're seeing is this high court challenge by a group called the Digital Freedom Project, which has been led by Libertarian Party MLC John Ruddick, that has challenged the law on the grounds of that it's unconstitutional because it infringes on the inferred right to freedom of political expression. In Australia, we don't have a Bill of Rights. We actually don't have an explicit a right to freedom of political expression, but my understanding is, I'm not a lawyer, so sorry if this is excruciating to anyone who is and I'm mangling it, but, you know, through years of case law and that kind of stuff, we do have this implied right. And this idea is that, you know, laws by their nature generally do tend to limit what people do. You know, they are in agreement not to do something so that things are better for all of us. But in the case of this challenge, which has now had its first directions hearing at the High Court and will take place next year, so the ban will go into effect and maybe it'll get struck down potentially later on, the case that they have to make is that the benefits of this law, the prevention of harm that the government says it's going to do, is worth the kind of infringement on those political freedoms, and that there's not a less onerous alternative that could get the same benefits without necessarily limiting our rights in the same way.
Cam, what happens now? We've had weeks, months, if not years of talk about this, starting with the 36 months campaign, a quick trip to New York for Communications Minister Annika Wells. That's caused
an expensive trip to New York.
That's caused some uproar, and we've had legal challenges from the kids. We're sort of almost at the point where the rubber meets the road. What happens now?
I think that there's been a lot of talk about this. There's been a lot of consternation about how it's going to work. My expectation is that it is actually going to be something that goes a little bit smoother than some of the worst predictions expect. I think one of the big things is that, as you mentioned before, Viv, that many of these platforms do have a lot of data about us, and they can actually use that to figure out our ages, often without us needing to do anything else. And I think because of that, many, if not most users probably won't even realize that their age has been checked. You know, they've been deemed, like a bouncer looking at your ID at the pub, they've been deemed old enough to kind of stay on the platforms. And so for that reason, I don't think most people are going to have to, for example, scan their face or provide ID. That being said, we do know how the media works. I'm part of the media, and I'm planning on doing this. Like, there will be plenty of attention paid to all the ways that it doesn't work. There'll be plenty of attention paid to, you know, what kids are doing. And of course, you know, that is newsworthy and interesting. But my prediction is, a month from now, 6 months from now, this will be something that will kind of fade into the background, because we are seeing this actually happen around the internet, is that we're seeing all these platforms essentially do more and more to kind of change how they treat younger users, whether they are limiting their experiences or banning them. I think Australia is very, very far into the most strict version of that, but this is kind of like a broader change. And once it's in the background, once, you know, most people have had their age checked and that, you know, they've proven that they're old enough to stay in the platforms, it kind of just becomes a non-issue. So my prediction is we'll see a bit of fireworks, but in a few months, people will be moving on to new things.
Cam Wilson is the associate editor of Crikey and co-author of Conspiracy Nation. Cam, thank you so much for joining us on Medialand today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Viv, whenever you're absent, I just, as you were last week, I always just assume you're off diving somewhere. I presume you've been off adventuring again. How did you fill the time on these long plane journeys?
Well, I was, for part of the time I was away, I was off diving off the northernmost tip of Australia in the Torres Strait. And yes, you are right, Tim, there was some time to fill. And as you know, I have previously worked in and written about the music industry as well as the media industry. And I love it when those two sort of intersect, because people think they're wildly different industries. And in a lot of cases, they're actually not. So there was an episode of a Shameless Media podcast, the Inherited podcast, where they interviewed one of their staff members, Eilish Gilligan. Now, she is a former musician, still a massive passion for music, but has sort of stopped chasing that career and is now a senior producer and journalist at Shameless Media, which makes some of the country's most successful podcasts. And she was sort of talking about why she gave up the dream of becoming a musician and how the music industry treated her. And she said that despite perceptions, the Australian music industry is actually an incredibly insular and conservative place. And when she was talking about it, I was like, oh my gosh, you could completely swap the words music industry for media industry here and it would still apply. So it was just really fascinating to hear about the business of the music industry and how that can actually quite easily transition into the business of the media industry.
Well, that is a great recommendation. And here's another one. Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And are you like Tim? Would you like to be banned from social media? We would love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Ban me, please, Zuck. Thank you to our producer, Rob Kelly. We'll catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on ABC Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodlepip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.